special thanks goes out to our Executive Director of Talent Bookings, Mr. Glenn Rivera, for tonight's guest. Glenn seems to be a music man, and it's really special, the people that he brings along to this show. And, you know, in the music industry, the word legend is thrown around quite often. This evening we do have a legend, and he comes to us by the way of Mr. Glenn Rivera. It's the legendary guitarist Dennis Coffey. Now, it's been said that Dennis has spent more time playing in Detroit studios and clubs than you've spent sleeping. And in the late 60s and the early 70s, Dennis would play as many as 18 sessions a week and then go out and do some live gigs on top of that. Dennis was born and raised near the old University of Detroit campus in Detroit City. He learned to play the guitar when he was only 13 years old, and when he was 15, moves quickly, he played his first recording session backing Vic Gallen on a track called I'm Gone. Now, also as a member of the Funk Brothers, Dennis has played guitar on over 1,000 soul music gold records at Motown and also in L.A. He's played with folks like The Temptations, Stevie Wonder, Diana Ross and Supremes, The Four Tops, Quincy Jones, Marvin Gaye, Martha Reeves, Ringo Starr, George Clinton, Freda Payne, Edward Starr, the Isley Brothers. The list just goes on and on. It's amazing. In fact, if you Google Dennis, by the way, his name is Coffey, Dennis Coffey, you'll bring up so many sites that it will take you a week to read them. Dennis also has two international top ten hits. Boy, I really should do this show every day. You could tell when I've been down a couple of days. Hits, thank you, Peter, with a track called Scorpio and Taurus. He's also written a movie theme called Black Belt Jones, and he's written a book about his life called Guitars, Bars, and Motown Superstars. What a title. You got to love that. We'll find out from Dennis where you can get a copy of that book. We have lots of music from Dennis, and we're so glad to have him on the show. Dennis Coffey, welcome to Strictly Confidential.
Here. It's just great. I love doing interviews.
Wonderful. Dennis, can you hear me okay?
Yeah, you broke up a little bit, but I can hear you now.
Okay, that's great. The studio has lots of knobs and dials and lights, and they can adjust things if things should degrade. So,
okay.
So you just let us know, Dennis. You are just amazing. How does a kid who starts playing guitar at 13 end up in a studio at 15? This is remarkable.
Well, practice. You know, when I was a kid in the summertime, I used to practice 8 hours a day when I was not in school, and you know, I've just been. That's been the story, actually, of my life. I still practice every morning. I mean, that's it's just I'm constantly learning the instrument. I consider myself a student, and that seems to get me into a lot of places. You know, I just got back from the Philadelphia, the R&B Foundation, where myself and the other funks were awarded a Pioneer Award, and that was good. And I've got a I'm going to be playing at the American Masters tribute to Les Paul at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in November. So just practice.
That's an amazing story. You're going to be playing at some huge events. Yet Les Paul, of course, is also a legend. Just amazing stuff. Did you come from a musical family? Where does your gift come from?
Well, I did have an aunt that recently passed away at the age of 97, and at the age of 96, she could sit down at the piano and play difficult pieces and not miss a note. And my mom played piano and sang, and her other sister played keyboard. So on my mom's side of the family, we're very musical.
Well, Dennis, what drew you to the studio? Does growing up in Detroit give you an insight into how to get into music? It seems that you went so quickly into studio production. Were you discovered? Was there a Schwab's drugstore moment?
I was playing in high school I went to McKinsey High School in Detroit, and I had a band, and we used to play on the breaks for the various sporting events. And I have no idea where this guy tracked me down and called me up, or somebody must have told him something. And then the next thing I knew, I was playing on this record. We did two songs, and I did a solo on each side. I was pretty happy. A guy giving me money to play on a record. I thought that was great.
I should think so. Who was in that band? Were any of your family involved in that early band, high
school? No, I had a drummer that I went to school with, Larry Blacknoe, and myself. And we had a guitar player, name was Lee, I can't think of his last name. He actually, we needed a bass player, so he tuned his guitar down lower and kind of tried to be a bass player for us. I think his name was maybe Lee Stage. He was the only guy that was older than us who had a driver's license, because we were both only 15. So that's kind of how that went down. So it was interesting. And, of course, Vic was the singer and the songwriter. And that's
how what was it? What was it? What kind of music did you play in that early band?
That was actually at the time was called rockabilly, kind of like the Elvis, the Memphis stuff, you know. And I had the opportunity a few years ago to play at the Gibson Guitar Factory in Memphis. And as part of this Ponderosa Stomp benefit we were giving, they had the original Sun Records rhythm section down there. Those surviving members backing up one of the original artists, Sonny Burgess. So I got a chance to see the real deal down in Memphis with the real guys. It was great.
Well, what do you recall the guitar that you played in those early days, and do you still have it?
That one I don't. I think it was called a Premier guitar, and it kind of probably looked like a Gibson Les Paul, but it was kind of a imitation of something I could afford, I guess. So that's what I think that very first one was. I don't know whatever happened to the brand.
So then when you went into the studio for the very first time as a 15-year-old kid, probably with a lump in your throat, you came in with that particular guitar?
Yes, uh-huh.
And when playing for the... What was it like? Was it like punching in a clock? Were you playing in separate sessions and the artist records later? What was it like recording that very first song with... what was his name? Vic Gallen.
You know, Vic Gallen, actually, he was singing it, and, you know, he sang it for us. I think he must have played rhythm guitar or something. And he sang the song for us, and we figured out how to play it. And then he just counted it off, and he sang, and we played as he sang, all of us together, and away we went.
So you sang directly onto it, what, a multiple-track recorder, a big Ampex in another room? Is that what was
Well, I don't know, because I was so... inexperienced, I have no idea what the engineer was doing, other than, you know, we got some good takes of both these songs that he wanted to do. I imagine it took us maybe 3-4 hours. And then we're sitting there listening to the playback, and he says, great, that's just what I wanted, and he paid us, and we went home.
Who was the man who actually hired you for that studio session?
Vic Gallen, the artist.
I see. So it wasn't a producer, it was the artist himself who found you on the maybe a high school football game or some sort of circuit. Did you ever find out how he found you? I guess not.
No, we did the session, and he said it'll be played on WEXL, which was a country station in one of the suburbs of Detroit. And he said it'll be played in a couple weeks on the radio, and he called us and gave us the time. And so here I am, a 15-year-old, 2 weeks later or 3 weeks later, listening to the radio, and here I come playing. That was great.
That had to be an experience at 15 years old, hearing yourself played on the local stations. Was the record widely played?
I think it was just promoted locally. I think he had his own label, and I don't know. Somehow, something went out, because I still have the original record, and some record collectors came up from somewhere down south and wanted to buy that copy from me, and I said, there's no way.
I would think you wouldn't sell that either. That's a special memory. At 45 RPM, and it was on the Gondola label?
Yes, uh-huh.
Did Gondola go on to produce others?
I think that was Vic's label.
I see. I
think maybe it was just, printed up some copies and tried to promote it, and that was it.
How did you move from Vic Gallen Who at the studio? Do you think someone at the studio heard you that day? Was it a Motown studio? Tell us about the studio and who owned it, and was it a primitive, simple studio? What was that all about?
There was a young guy that had a studio in his basement, and he just was, you know, like I say, other than, you know, you see all the knobs and stuff, and you don't know what they are, but, you know, he got it to sound pretty good. And when I play the record, by the way, it still sounds good. So he did a good job.
I should say so. Some of the earlier 45 RPMs, the EQ is often kind of rough on those. How did you make your way to Motown from a basement studio?
Well, that was a long journey because at 16, I was playing with a band called the Pyramids, and I was playing a teen club every Friday night and a wedding every Saturday night. And I had a partner called Durwood Hutto, and we were doing some jobs, and he was like an Elvis kind of singer, and I'd play guitar, and we'd do USO shows and stuff. And then we ended up cutting a demo of a record called Crazy Little Satellite at Fortune Records. And somehow the woman running Fortune Records hooked us up with Nat Tarnopol, who was Jackie Wilson's producer manager. And we ended up going in the studio at 16, the two of us, singing and recording a song we wrote. And the arranger of that session was actually Barry Gordy. And I don't think Barry probably even knows. I met him briefly at the 50th anniversary of Motown in Detroit this past December. But I don't think he probably still maybe is not aware of that person that he met at that time as an arranger doing this record that never came out on, I guess they tried to shop it. This was pre-Motown Records. And then he had a partner called Billy Davis that called us about a year later, said they were trying to start a label and would we be interested. And we were pretty much discouraged with the record business. We were kind of burned out at 16. We said we don't want to sign with any more labels.
I see. So you and other members of the band were included, so you came as kind of a group into the business.
Well, it was different people that I worked with throughout my career, where I was doing the teen clubs, and then I joined the Army, and I was doing some, I was in the 101st Airborne Division, so I was playing in Kentucky, and then I transferred down to South Carolina, and I was recording down in South Carolina with some people, and I recorded with Maurice Williams. I did the record that he had out after he did Stay, and I was doing sessions, actually, while I was in the Army. I'd do my Army thing during the day and do sessions playing clubs at night, and I actually had a record out as an artist on May, but they told me Dennis Coffey would never sell any records, so they changed my name to Clark Summit, which I found in some town in Pennsylvania or something.
Well, I noticed that in your very, 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 very long list of labels you record on, you recorded on Summit. Was that a derivative of that?
Boy, I don't know. I'd have to look it up, but that might have been another label, but I know Clark Summit was the name they gave me. And at this point, of course, I was still probably 19 when I had this thing. It was the first artist thing, and it really didn't take off. And then at 20, I was out of the service, and I was working in clubs in Detroit where you had to be 21. So I had jumped out of airplanes and spent 2 years in the military, and here I am working in a club, still not 21, and the vice cops come in. And it's the day before my 21st birthday, and they asked to see my ID, and because I was a veteran, I was a little smarter than I would have been a few years previous, so I kind of palmed my wallet and stepped on it and told them I forgot it. And they were going to come in the next day, which I would have been 21. They said, we're coming back tomorrow, and you either have your wallet and show us you're 21, or we're going to bust you and the guy running the place. But they never came back the next day. I would have been 21, but not after midnight.
Dennis, you said you mentioned that when they were asking you to sign, you were at 16 years old. You were saying that no way do we want to sign on any more labels. What were your experiences like then with labels? Did you have some bad ones?
That was the first one where we did this record, and Nat Tarnopol promised it'd come out and all this stuff. And you know, to kids who thought that, of course, within a week we were going to be big stars, and that didn't happen, and the year dragged on and on. So finally we approached Nat and says, you know, we're not having this. We need to have our contract back because you guys really didn't deliver. And it's kind of a long story. The details are in the book, but we got the contract back, and then we were just disgusted with the business and said, you know, this stuff isn't really doesn't seem to be for us. So that's how we really kind of got turned off about the record business.
Interesting. Well, one of the reasons that you were turned off was because they were asking you to record things that you didn't that didn't come from within. Is that part of it? Did you just not like session work?
They didn't give us a deal. We had no record. We had a record and never came out. So, I mean, what's the purpose of cutting the record if it's never going to come out?
What was that very early record that was never released?
That was the one called that we wrote called Crazy Little Satellite. And I don't have a copy of that, and I don't know if anybody does, but it never came out.
That would, I see, yes. You mentioned that perhaps we could, one of our expert Googlers in the chat room can locate some information on that. It's not something
that...
That
would be a real long shot. A real long shot. But you never know. Nothing surprises me.
Dennis, I'm finding out that you have introduced some various sounds to Motown. For instance, I'm reading that you introduced the wah-wah sound to Motown. Tell us how that went, and were you involved with the electronics of? Did you do it manually? How did you do the wah-wah thing?
Well, what had happened I was in a producer's workshop working for Motown in the evening, so producers could try out ideas, and I was playing in a jazz club with the Lyman Woodard Trio, and you know Jimi Hendrix, I think, and some of the guys were using wah-wah pedals. It was just a fairly new thing in pop records, and especially in psychedelic records. And I had a friend, Joe Podorsik, who actually taught Ted Nugent guitar, and he had a music store. And so anything new that came up, he'd call me, and I'd come down and try it out, because I was very interested in just trying out new devices. And so I got a wah-wah pedal very early on. And when we rehearsed this song for Norman Whitfield called Cloud Nine, and I happened to pull out this wah-wah pedal and start playing it, he just freaked out. He says, "That's what I've been looking for." And then within 2 weeks, I was down in the snake pit recording Cloud Nine.
Very interesting. We have a number of your tracks here uploaded to the studio, and I'd certainly like the listeners to hear, because I think some of the listeners, and let's talk about this before we play a track. I'm hearing that today you are sampled very often by the hip-hop groups like the LL Cool J. And who are some of the groups who are sampling your old music and using them in modern recording?
The first one was Chuck D of Public Enemy, and he was on the show the day before yesterday. He came up to me and wanted, you know, introduced himself, and he also performed, and he told me, he says, "We really wanted to hire you guys, but the record label wouldn't give us any money, so we sampled you." And he felt bad about that, and he says, and I autographed a couple of his books for him and stuff that he had. We had some books there that were programs and stuff, but we had a conversation, and, he said, "Yeah, I tried to get in touch with you and sent you an email, and you never answered." I said, "Well, I didn't get it," so we exchanged numbers and things, but he was probably the first one that I noticed that was sampling some of my work.
I see. And was that Scorpio one of your releases that you recorded?
There's a song on the Evolution album called Getting It On. And I was so surprised when I was doing another album, and I asked Eric Morgeson of the studio I was working at to play me some of the other funky stuff to see what everybody else was doing. And he pulls out this Public Enemy record. He plays me this track, and I says, "I don't remember getting paid for that session, but it's clearly me playing the guitar."
Very interesting. Perhaps we can introduce then some of you. What year was the Getting It On produced, and we can tell the listeners a little bit about it before we run it?
I think that came out in probably 1971, maybe in November. So we probably recorded it late 70, early 71.
I see. Agnes, do you have a copy? I believe you have a copy loaded from the zip files called Getting It On. If you'd roll that for the listeners, please. Roll it, Agnes. We'll be right back. ago. Dennis, we have so much of your music, so much wonderful music. I asked the studio to fade that a little bit early. Tell us, did he tell you how he came across that track or how he found you? Because it would seem such an obscure connection between you and a hip-hop group.
You know what? I'm not sure how these guys found me. I have no idea. And then there were so many people there at this event. I mean, Dionne Warwick sang, Aretha was there, Jerry Butler, everybody was there. You know, so Bonnie Raitt, everybody. It was just so chaotic that we didn't really get that much time to really talk.
I see. And was it the riff that was played throughout the beginning, is that the part that they used?
Yes, uh-huh.
Interesting. And did they sample it as a basic track all through the recording, or was it a small part? I'm wondering how much they relied on it.
I think they took about 8 bars of that guitar figure, and they looped it, sounds like to me.
I see. So many of the artists that we talked to, from 60s and 70s, have had music sampled. I can see why they do it. It's the music from that era, 60s, 70s, 80s, is a huge treasure trove of music. One doesn't always get credit for it, though. In fact, a lot of our music guests tell us that they really got very little credit back in the day. How was your relationship with the companies? Were you ever paid royalties, or did you work on a salary? We've heard some very different stories along those lines about how the music industry worked back in the day.
When I had the Scorpio, a monster hit, and I was the writer and the artist, I got paid what I thought was good. You know, I got royalty checks. As far as the samplers, some of the early ones didn't pay me. But Clarence Avon, who owned Sussex Records at the time, and I showed him all the samplers. And I think at the time he was chairman of the board at Motown, so I think he talked to the other execs in the labels that he knew and said, you know, let's just try and settle up, you know, the sampling stuff rather than making it all court stuff. Let's just kind of take care of some of this so our guys get paid. And I did get some of the money from the sampling.
Interesting. Is that our artists, in other words, that's what most musicians are doing these days?
No, I know Armin Baladian at Westbound is suing tons of people over samples they took from his label. He's actively doing that in court now.
Interesting. Yeah, they use the music years later with no credit. You mentioned that was about 1971. Was Scorpio also around 1971? What was the year Scorpio?
Album.
It was. And so Scorpio was the huge hit.
Yeah, that was the Evolution album. And interestingly enough, that album had been out for a year, and nothing happened. So I had already commenced to record an album without the guitar band. And then I got a call from Ron Mosley in New York. He said, I've been going to these dance clubs, and they're just banging away at this Scorpio thing. He says, I'm gonna put a hold on this album you're working on, and I'm gonna resurface Scorpio because it just seems to be doing great here in New York.
Interesting. What types of clubs was Scorpio being played in?
Most of the dance clubs in New York, and that thing, once it started going, I remember the R&B station, WJLB here, was like the powerhouse R&B station, and the record was 13 one week. And I was listening in the car radio to see what number it got the following week. And then they kept going up the chart, and it wasn't there. So by the time I got to the top five, I just figured it fell off. It went from 13 to number one in one week.
Wow. Well, before we introduce the listeners to Scorpio or remind them, they probably already know it, how did Scorpio come to mind? How was it created?
It's the way I usually write. Also, I've just finished writing quite a few new songs. Is I just sit down usually with an acoustic guitar and start banging away, and just these songs show up. You know, I say, wow, what was that? Oh, that's kind of nice. Let's make a song of it.
I see. Interesting. Well, Agnes, you'll have the Scorpio track from the Zip set also. Let's run some of that for the listeners. Scorpio, Dennis Coffey.
Thank you.
this, we started listening to that, and I got so deeply into it, I almost forgot to ask Agnes to fade it, because it's such a, with a break like that, the temptation for DJs to remix that or extend it had to be huge. Was that commonly done? Was that what they were doing in the clubs, remixing that?
I'm not sure. I went to a few of the dance clubs in New York, and because of that section is pretty long as it is, at that time, I think the remixing thing wasn't as big as it became later on. So when the clubs that I happen to be in, they seem to be just playing it straight through. They just turn up the volume in that breakdown.
I see. Interesting. In listening to it also, it's a sort of track when listening to it, you would swear that you heard it in a movie somewhere. You'd just swear because it has that sort of, it really just has a movie quality to it. Did you write that about the time you did the movie score?
No. Actually, Scorpio was out and a hit, and I had a few albums under my belt, and then I moved to L.A. in 1973, and I decided I wanted to do a movie score. So Clarence Avant had talked to someone at Warner Brothers, and they had this film, Black Belt Jones, that needed a theme song and needed a connection to a record release, and he got me that job to write Black Belt Jones and the main love theme for that film and record it.
Interesting. What was your thought? Did they let you see clips of the movie?
I saw clips of it, and so I knew generally what they were looking for, and I just kind of did my thing, but I did one thing different. I used 8 voices as the lead instrument, and so I used them through an amp through a wah-wah pedal. So I had the voices doing the melodies, and then I had a counterpoint with 4 different sections of voices in the breakdown. I overdubbed them as I played my wah-wah pedal, and I shot them through the amp. So I was always trying some new things.
I see. Well, I take it, theme from Black Belt Jones, that was an action flick. It just had to be with a name like that. What was it?
Yes.
A full-blown action?
Yes. I still was playing a club gig a couple weeks ago, and they were asking for a Black Belt Jones, and I do it probably a little bit faster than I used to, but it's fun, and they like it. So, I still do the club circuit around here, and then I go out and do concerts and things, but I still play all the time because it's fun.
Well, did the movie Black Belt Jones ever make it from videotape to DVD? Is it still, can you find it still if you wanted to?
I think you probably can. I know I got a video of it, and it probably is on DVD. I don't think I've looked for it on DVD, or I may have. I'm not sure.
Interesting. What was it like when you saw it in the theater and saw your name roll by in the music credits?
Well, there were 2 issues that I had within the screening. First of all, they misspelled my name, so that didn't
matter. Oh, no.
Second,
let's get that straight for the listeners. It's C-O-F-F-E-Y. How did they spell it?
C-O-F-F-Y.
Oh, I
That's
see.
What they had. It's supposed to be C-O-F-F-E-Y. And the second thing is I noticed very quickly that all the action slaps and smacks and kicks were all 10 times louder than my music, so that kind of turned me off. But And I just decided I wouldn't do any more of them, and I didn't.
I see. Well, let's give the listeners a hint of what that was like. This is an action flick. What, from what year, Black Belt Jones?
This was probably, I would think, 74, 75.
I see. Back in the day when the dance floors were packed and everybody was having a ball. Agnes, you've got it listed as theme from Black Belt Jones. Roll it, please.
Thank you.
Perfect action figure track, or action movie track. Where were you again when this was requested recently?
I was playing in a club, and of course, my partner Mike Theodore did the great horn and string parts on that record, and he was my production partner as well, and we did arrangements together. And I was playing in a Corktown Tavern was the name of the club. It's mainly like a young folks club, and they through the samplers know who I am, and the place was packed, and this one guy, he just said, I had to hear Black Belt Jones. And at the same time as he came in the club, that was the day that we were also on NPR National Radio because of the Rodriguez project that's been re-released that Mike and I produced back in the late 60s.
Interesting. Dennis, tell us about your relationship with the Dramatics. Now, the Dramatics had been around for quite a while. Was it you that put them over the top back in 71, 72?
The first records I did for the Dramatics was the Echoplex sound on In the Rain, which is another device I had that was an echo unit. And I was probably one of the first ones to use that, certainly on an R&B record. And I used that in the introduction. You can hear that Echoplex device going, and that kind of gave it that rainy kind of texture to the song.
I see. This was in the R&B charts.
That was a hit record, and What You See Is What You Get was another big record they had that I played a different unit on the bass line. And oddly enough, both those records were recorded in Detroit, but they came out on Stax because Don Davis was the producer.
Interesting. What was the scenario? Were you in a studio with them, or did this get laid down later after they sang it? There's so many different ways to do this.
What we've always done back in the day is that was recorded at United Sound, and I'm not sure exactly who the arranger was. I know Don Davis was the producer. And we'd come show up for the session. The singers may be there, but they're not singing when we play. And what happens is that we read the charts and come up with a feel and some hot licks, and generally speaking, we're expected to complete one song an hour. And every session is 3 hours, and we were expected to record 3 songs and make them hits. And, of course, when we walked in the door, there's the music. The producer or arranger would count the song off. We'd read the music, and he'd kind of give us a little coaching. And within an hour, we were expected to record that as a hit.
My stars. You know, this echoes what we've heard from some of the other folks who have been in the business, that it was almost a production line. And you punched in, and you went to work at like an 8 to 5, but you were expected to create, you know, to do magic. Is that the way it felt?
Yeah, we were having fun because we were all friends, all the players, you know, and in Philadelphia, I'm sitting there on the stage with Bob Babbitt and Eddie Willis and Uriel Jones, and we did all these Motown things together, but we probably did just as much non-Motown sessions together. And I'm looking at Eddie. I'm saying, yeah, Eddie, remember, you know, while we're talking to the audience, and when we did the I Want to Testify with George Clinton, you and I played the guitars on that, and he says, yeah, and we talked about all these different things, and just a tremendous amount of history with all these folks. You know, going back so many years, I was playing with Babbitt in bars and stuff before we made a lot of records, and then with Uriel and Eddie Willis all the time on all these other sessions in addition to the Motown things. It's just a lot of history.
Well, I'm seeing here that In the Rain actually made it all the way up to at least number 5 on the pop charts, too. Is that right? That's what I'm reading.
Probably so. I know for a solid year, when I looked at the Billboard Top 100, I was in 3 songs in the top 10 for a year straight and 10 songs in the top 100 for a year straight.
Wow. Well, I'd love for those.
Wilson Pickett, and that included the Dramatics, all the Motown acts. Plus, I was over at Holland Dozier Holland doing the chairman of the board and Freda Payne and all those folks. And you just stir it all up, and then doing George Clinton and getting in his stuff. And at the end of the day, it was just a lot of product, and they were doing it. That was the Detroit sound. That was the magic of the players here in Detroit and the production.
What was the track with Wilson Pickett? Unfortunately, I don't think we have a Wilson Pickett track loaded up at the studio, but he was such a wonderful artist. What did you do with Wilson Pickett?
I got a call from, I think it was Brad Shapiro, was one of his producers, and they wanted me to come down to Muscle Shoals, and they said, we want you to work 5 days in Muscle Shoals with Wilson Pickett, and we'll pay you double scale. and we'll fly you down. I says, in Muscle Shoals? I says, well, okay. And at the same time, I had a call from Aretha Franklin's people wanting me to play a live concert with her. So, obviously, 5 days' worth of work at double scale, as great as Aretha was at the time, I took the double scale and went down and spent a week in Muscle Shoals, and we recorded Don't Knock My Love. And that was a big hit for Wilson. And oddly enough, 2 years ago, when I did the Four Tops 50th anniversary, Aretha was on that show, so I finally got to play with her.
Wow. Wow. Well, I'd love for the listeners to have a chance to hear In the Rain. It's one of the tracks that we have uploaded, and it's a different sound than you've heard with the previous tracks we've played. It's absolutely wonderful. Agnes, if you'd roll In the Rain, please. You know, Dennis, I can still remember hearing that on the car radio. I think back at the time, actually, it was a truck radio I was listening to it on. But, you know, some of these songs have a place in everyone's heart and from back in the day. In fact, the chat room really loved that, remembers that song. What was it that you called that instrument? It was something wah-wah double? Or I have
no,
described that again.
That was called an echoplex. And it was a form of tape delay echo that you ran your guitar into, and you could set the frequency or the tempo of the delay to match the tempo of the song. So you hear in the beginning where it's going, yay, that's that echoplex sound.
I see. Now, was that a unit that you could transport with you to plug in your guitar amp? Was it like a loop of tape, or did you have to do it in a studio reel-to-reel?
No, it was a box that had a reel-to-reel tape built right in it. It was a small carryable box that you could carry. It wasn't very heavy or that big, so you carried this little box in and sat it down. You ran it through that.
My stars, how times have changed, haven't they, did it?
Oh, that you ought to see what they got now. The same size, it carries three pedals in it that does all kinds of stuff, which is about the same size as that one Echoplex box.
I see. Now, the Echoplex, was this a new sound for R&B when you introduced it for Within the Rain?
It's like the Wah-Wah for R&B was the first Wah-Wah pedal used on an R&B record. I'm pretty sure this was the first Echoplex used on an R&B record.
I see. Very interesting. The chat room is mentioning Freda Payne's Band of Gold. Tell us about Freda Payne. Freda Payne came later in the 70s, did she not? Tell us how you met her. What was she like to work with?
When Holland Dozier and Holland left Motown, they started up, they had a couple of their own labels. One was through Buddha and one was through Capitol. I think they had Hot Wax and Invictus. And so they had a recording studio they built in Tower Theater. It was a Tower Theater. I used to go to that theater as a kid. And so what they would do is as they started rolling, they had a separate rhythm section. They started off at first using some of the Motown guys until Motown probably put a stop to it. But because I wasn't signed to Motown, I could play on their sessions. So, Motown at one time told me they didn't want me doing that, and I said, well, there's not much you can do about it. You know, I'm a free agent. And so they kind of got miffed and didn't call me for 2 weeks. After that, I was doing Motown every day for 6 hours, two sessions. Then I'd go do the production workshop from 7 to 9:30 at night, and then I'd go across town at 10 o'clock and do a session from 10 to 1 or 2 with HDH. And we would do Chairman of the Board, we would do The Honeycomb, we would do Freda Payne, we would do all the groups that were in their stable at the time. I ended up playing in all those records as well.
Wow. Well, we have a caller on the line for you, Dennis. We have VJC. This is Victor. Victor runs Disco 935 in New York. Victor, welcome. You're with myself and Mr. Dennis Coffey.
Hi, Peter. Hi, Dennis. It's VJC. I run Disco 935 here in New York. I run the more 70s, 80s disco from beyond. I run a lot of your tracks, you know, Winds of Fire, the C&J company stuff. I'm just thrilled to be talking to Dennis Coffey, one of the, I can't even explain what I'm going to say to you because it's like,
I thank you for calling, and I certainly appreciate anybody who plays my records. You get a big thanks and shout-out from me.
Yeah, Dennis, I've been playing your records since day one. Back to Scorpio.
Okay.
I was chatting with the guys in the chat room, was that Scorpio here in New York back in the day, I don't know if you remember Africa Bombard and all those stuff about hip-hop movement back in the day.
Right.
They started playing that track, the break part, and just kept on bringing it back and forth, and it was just amazing how they were just bringing this stuff out. And if it wasn't for that, I wouldn't really had been really turned on to the sound of Scorpio. And then obviously I found that you were also playing with Mike Didio, and it's just amazing the type of music you made back in the 60s and the 70s. It's just classic stuff that even today, it's timeless. It's just timeless. I could play just right today. It feels like I'm back in a time zone.
If you hear the stuff, and of course Theater was my production partner and the great horn and string arranger. If you listen to the work we did on CJ and Company, you can really hear that coming through.
Sure. I mean the whole album was just amazing. I mean that album itself and a couple albums after that. But that album, when I first heard it, the part of with the Devil's Gun and I'm just off the top of my head. I'm trying to remember all the songs because I'm really not by my computer. But it was just amazing production work.
Don't forget it was mixed by Tom Moulton. I mean, this guy was amazing.
Yeah, yes, we shouldn't forget that. Yes, we shouldn't forget that. the thing is, it's unfortunate. What I was trying to catch a show, but I had a water main break here in New York and where I live, so I was trying. I'm trying to catch a show at the same time.
Okay.
So it's just unfortunate. It's always like that, and you know, in life, you just never know what's going to happen.
That's true. That's true.
But I just really called to talk to you to say that I've talked to Dennis Coffey along with the other of stuff, other groups that I, and other artists that I've talked to the last couple of months with Peter's had on has on, and you have to excuse me because I'm very like disoriented a little because it's the water problem and all that. But the fact of the matter is I am really pleased and honored to be talking to Dennis Coffey.
Just remember, it's the people who play our music in the clubs, it's the people who buy the records and come to hear us play that really get us where we are. We don't do it by ourselves. It's kind of like a partnership with the people who really like our music, so we're very appreciative.
Right, and that's why, I mean, I've been DJing since 1975. I was always pushing out music, back in the day from that, that time zone and everything. I'm still doing it. I'm still trying to bring it back, but it's just the audience, and especially here in New York, the radio stations just don't play a lot of the stuff from back in the day anymore.
Yeah, what I do is I go out and I've got a band of some young cats, and I'll take Scorpio, and every night we play it different. We just take it out to a whole other place, and it rejuvenates it because I never try and play anything the same more than once. Maybe it's just because my studio background, or maybe I have a short attention span. But I'll guarantee you, anytime you hear me play my stuff, whether I'm doing Black Dog Jones or Scorpio or anything, it will be different every time I play it.
So it's basically like a remix every time.
Yeah, absolutely, because we break it down in the middle. You can go on YouTube and hear me playing with some cats from New Orleans on a couple of things, and then you can see me on YouTube playing the same songs with my guys up here, and it's different each time.
Yeah, you know, it's just amazing the music back in the day that you made with Mike. Even his stuff that he did on his LPs.
Oh, yeah.
The music, I mean, just almost every cut that I heard from Mike and you, it's just, to me, it's classic, classic stuff that, I mean, I could just play forever. I mean,
well,
I would get bored playing it.
Well, Mike and I still talk, and occasionally we work together, but just like with the Funk Brothers and everything, we're all still friends, and we all talk. And I just did a big session up here back in March for a friend of mine from London, and I got together all the Motown gang again, you know, and I brought in the Funk Brothers and Dave Vanderpit on charts and the whole thing, man, and we knocked this stuff out, and the guy said, that's what I'm talking about, and took the tracks back home with him.
You know, I'm just hearing you talking about that stuff about Motown and everything, and I'm getting goosebumps. I mean, It just blows me away that, I mean, I'm 52 years old, and I've been hearing Motown stuff and all this when I was a teenager. And I can't believe 30, 40 years later, I'm talking to Dennis Coffey about this. I mean, I feel like, oh, okay. I mean, it's like sometimes, am I in the same room with like a legend? You know?
The Motown thing is a spiritual thing because when that museum, before they created the Motown Museum, they had locked the door to the studio, and it probably stayed locked for 30 years. And I went over there to show them how to stage the studio, who played what, so they could buy the instruments to put them in the studio. And they opened that door, and I walked in that room that had been shut for 30 years, and there was some kind of force in there. I could feel something in there, some kind of vibe, man, it was real spooky. I mean, you could just feel there was something in there, you know, some kind of... just the vibe, it's almost like you could feel, like maybe
because
parts of those people that have gone away that aren't there anymore, some kind of presence of folks in that room.
Right, it's just that it's somehow, it's something weird, it's like 60s, 70s music, whatever, it was made to be made that way. It's like today's music, the way they make it today, it's just a different time zone, a different, aura back in that time. Everything
was
different. So, you know, obviously we didn't have computers and everything. Everything was done live, and the instruments and everything, the vocals. I mean, it was just a magical, magical time to make music. It's unfortunate today it's not like that no more because everything is about the dollars. Everything is about a computer. You know, like do a quick track and make a quick dollar. But it's not. It wasn't. I, to my knowledge, I don't think it was done back in the time back then. I think it was just done. You guys were doing it to make something to last. It was
made out of
the soul.
Yeah, the only thing that we had is because the clock was running and people had to get paid. So usually our challenge was if we go into a session, would be 3 hours, and we were expected to complete one song every hour and make it a hit.
Oh, wow. And did Barry Gordy push you all hard?
Barry was never in the studio, except I saw him only in the studio twice because I was doing work for Motown and everybody else in L.A. And both times I saw Barry in the studio, he had Dinah Ross with him. And
wow.
One time I was in an overdub room and I was doing all this freak out feedback and I looked up and Barry and Diana were looking in the room like they didn't know what the hell I was doing.
It's just amazing that you're telling me these stories of back in the day. I can only imagine what went on because I was a young kid. I mean, you know, and
my book has the details of all that. I tried to paint a picture of, you know, like I'm a fly on the wall so that people can read my book and they can see and maybe feel a little bit of what went on in all those sessions.
Well, just talking to you 5-10 minutes, I could feel it from what you're just talking to me right now. I mean, and also because I wasn't there with you and with Diana and it, but I used to listen to the music, that music, so I felt like I was there with you guys too.
Sure,
you know,
sure.
Well, in other words, we're all fans. I'm a big fan from Motown, big fan of the 70s disco movement, all that stuff. I mean, obviously that's why I run Disco 93.5 because I'm trying to bring that back. But It's just unfortunate that today's kids they're just not into that stuff, which is really real music.
Well, you know, the last couple of years, you know, I've been playing live. I did the South by Southwest Music Conference, and we rocked. Of course, I had Little Buck Senegal's band from New Orleans backing me up with three horns, and I had Buckwheat Zydeco on B3 organ, so we were cranking.
Oh.
And they got it. The House of Blues the following year in New Orleans, they got it. They understand it. If you give them the funk and you push it out there in a live performance and just really go, they get it.
I mean,
Buckwheat Zydeco on B3 is amazing.
Down south, when you play with the guys from Memphis or New Orleans, man, they got the funk. It's just there.
Yeah, I'm trying to say the words, but I don't know what to say because it's like, it was just a magical time.
You just want
to bottle that up, you know, and it's you can't go back to it, but you can
always. No, you can.
Yeah, you can always relive it by, that's why I keep on bringing it back.
Well,
every time I play my mixes, I freak out.
Well, I was in Philadelphia here a couple days ago at the R&B Pioneers. The R&B Foundation gave the Funk Brothers an award, and it was myself and Eddie Willis on guitar and Bob Babbitt on bass and Uriel Jones on drums, the four of us. Now, we had played together off and on probably since 1963-64 on non-Motown sessions and Motown sessions, so... For that moment, we were doing this Motown medley in front of the crowd. And, of course, Dionne Warwick was there and Aretha and everybody and Chaka Khan and Jerry Butler, you name it, they were all there. So for that brief moment again,
and I have all that
back.
Stuff, too. Weird. It's weird. I can't believe that a lot of the stuff that you played on it, because I try to read all the liner notes and everything, but
sure.
I'm doing so much DJ work that I can't even – and usually Glenn emails me with the stuff, or he always – updates me with that stuff, so I usually read on that.
Uh-huh.
But I just wish I had more time to read up on all the stuff.
Starting to lose the signal.
Victor, we're having a technical issue, and thank you for calling in, Victor. That's our wonderful and loyal listener, Victor from Disco 935 in New York. Thank you for calling, Victor. We had a technical dropout there. And speaking of Victor, I should go ahead and give you the numbers again. The toll-free line is 877, the number 4 head-on. That's toll-free, 877-443-2366. Mail arrives to Peter for tonight. It arrives to Peter at petergodbull.com. And you can also use 304-658-3333. You know, Victor, that was a great call. So you guys talked about so many things, but one of the things you mentioned again, Dennis, was that you were expected to create these classics in 1 hour. Now, of course, that speaks to the pressure, but what we really haven't looked at is how that speaks to the absolute genius of the people in those rooms. Who could do that? Who could write music like that? that endured this long with that kind of pressure. It's really hard to comprehend.
Well, we didn't know that we were creating classics. We were just having fun, and we were making money, and we were creating music, you know, with one another, you know, as band members. And it was probably, I would say that the Motown years playing with the Funks was probably one of the highlights of my career, you know, just because it was fun, and every day was different. And, of course, you know, Jamerson was one of my best friends over there, and he and I used to do a few clubs together once in a while, and it was just all the guys, Earl Van Dyke, Bongo, just all of them. We just had a blast.
I see. Well, was the track with Frida Payne, it was mentioned in the chat room earlier, the Band of Gold track, was that done in one of the Make It a Hit in 1 hour sessions?
Absolutely. And some of those, I had my electric, Coral electric sitar on there, and that one part was written by the arranger for that particular song. You can, you know, that's how it fits with the thing so well, because it was notated.
Wow. Wow, that just blows me away that it could be done that way, and my hat goes off to you, sir. A song you'll all remember, and hard to believe that it was written under pressure. Frida Payne doing Band of Gold. Roll it, Agnes. Dennis, just a plain wow. Of course, I remember owning that album. I remember playing it really, really loud in an apartment I had in Tallahassee. And, you know, and I remember dancing to it in clubs, and God knows how many drag queens have done it.
I played with, you know, T.J. Lubinsky called me up. He does all those PBS specials and invited me to play in the Rhythm, Love, and Soul special that Frida was on, and I spent about 2 or 3 days in Pittsburgh filming that one special and playing with everyone. So it was kind of like getting a chance to play with some of the people again.
I see. And also, during the 80s, of course, Sylvester did a version of that, which was remixed many, many times. And it's amazing, even though the different artists have done that, it always has the same, the sitar part. How did you pull that off? Tell us again about the sitar part. I would not have known that was a sitar in the break had you not told us.
Originally, way back in the day, I bought a real Indian sitar and used it on a couple of gigs, but it was so big and I never really figured out how to play it properly. So at that time, Coral was a guitar company, and they kind of saved me by inventing, I think maybe with Vinnie Bell or somebody, they invented an electric sitar. Oh, that was built like an electric guitar, and it had sympathetic drone strings and everything, and I bought one. And so I used to use that on some sessions, you know, when people needed that. And for this particular session, I happened to have it with me.
Wow. So it was a spur of the moment with that break. Unbelievable. Just unbelievable to have a look at the inner workings of some of the songs. I'm like Victor. It's like a total wow having you on the show with us this evening, Dennis. Another thanks goes out to Mr. Glenn Rivera for lining it up. You and Victor mentioned Devil's Gun, CJ and Company. Tell us about how that song, I want to run that, but tell us about how that song came together and about CJ.
Okay, what happened was is that CJ and Company, part of that group used to be a group called The Strides. And Mike Theodore and I had recorded that group quite a few years earlier, and we just reconnected with them later on. And quite frankly, the idea of, we were talking to Armin Baladian at Westbound, and we were doing a little market research and figuring out, you know, what's really selling. What is this disco stuff that's selling all these records? And Mike Theodore.
What is this disco stuff?
Yeah,
love it.
You know, yeah, Mike Theodore and I used to attend some of the Billboard conventions. And that's where we encountered, you know, new Tom Moulton was doing a lot of the mixes, and he seemed to be just a real expert at that. And so I kind of studied a bunch of the disco records, and then we sat down and looked at the style. And Devil's Gun was written by, I can't think of the writer right now, but he was from England. And we were listening to all these demos, and we just picked up on this one song and said, we're going to do a disco record, and we're going to use this group that we had. And we're going to, first of all, create that kind of music, and second of all, when it's done, we're going to give it to Tom Moulton and have him do a real good disco mix of it, and that's how that came to be.
Amazing. And, of course, the rest is history, and everyone will know the track. I don't know if we have a version that runs about 7 minutes, and I don't know if it's Tom Moulton did this or not. Tom Moulton did the original mix on it, you say?
Yes, he did. He did the whole album, and
wow.
He did some albums of mine, too. One that I had called Back Home, I think it was, that he mixed that, did a great job on that, too.
Okay. Well, then, of course, Tom Moulton had added any remix following the original would have Tom. By the way, Tom Moulton's been on the show, Dennis,
okay.
A wonderful, wonderful guest. We enjoyed having him. What history he has. Let's run CJ and Company, the incredible hit Devil's Gun. Roll it, Agnes. We'll be right back. Dennis, what a remarkable track. And you know what? It's always, by the way, let's do it. You said earlier, let's do a disco version of this. Wow, you certainly did it. And what a wonderful energy it has. Who added the kettle drums to that track? That was a great thing to do.
We did that, and of course Mike Theodore needs to be given credit for those fantastic horn and string arrangements. I mean, they were smoking. Usually by then I did the rhythm section, and we brought in, I think with the overdubs, we brought in a timpani and had somebody do that along with the string and horns, you know, the orchestra, and he did such great orchestral charts. I mean, that whole thing was just smoking with the Detroit rhythm section and the Detroit symphony and everything. It was wild.
Wow, so this was a really full, and it has that feel about it, too. Some of the other our guests we've had have talked about back in the day when they would walk into a studio and a full orchestra was there and how, you know, what a wonderful feeling it added. So that was with just amazing to me.
We used probably had about 22 strings on that, and we certainly had at least 8 horns. And, you know, we had cello, viola, and first and second violins. We had a pretty healthy string section, so it was a nice section.
Well, I'll tell you what, Dennis, they can sample it, but they can never do it again. And by the way, Glenn Rivera is in our chat room. I want to remind Glenn, Agnes just reminded me, I had forgotten about it. Glenn did a Halloween mix for us during the Halloween of last year. He put together a mix set for us that we called, and he used Devil's Gun in the Halloween mix. Why not? It was great fun. You've mentioned your books, and by the way, folks, and Dennis, we are posting links to your site in the chat room. Many of the listeners, though, are not in the chat room. Let me give you Dennis's site if you are not in our chat room. That is denniscoffeesite.com. That is DennisCoffeeSite.com. Again, that's denniscoffeesite.com. Also, just a few minutes ago, you mentioned guitars, bars, and Motown superstars, and I'm so glad you did. Tell us about the book, and we'll want to know where it's available too. But how did that book come together?
I had been meeting some folks who used to come over from London, and there was a bar in the suburbs of Detroit, and these folks would show up there because one of the guys that used to live in London lived there, and they were talking about Northern soul music and getting all these stories out of me about some of these records that they loved that were done here in the 60s in Detroit. And another friend of mine said, well, why don't you write a book about all these stories? So I said, well, okay. So I wrote a book, and it took me longer to get it out. It took me 2 years to write it, but it took me longer to get it out. And it was so weird because through the Northern Soul folks, there was one of the guys was in London that was kind of an expert in Northern Soul, and this other friend of mine connected me with this guy, and he said, geez, I'd really like to read your book. I might be able to get your publisher over here. So what I ended up doing was I sent him a few emails with a couple chapters attached to each email. And after he had received the whole book, he sent me back a note. He says, I didn't mean for you to send it all to me right now. You got my working over here in overtime. So anyways, he ended up, read the book. He loved it. So he hooked me up with Be Cool Publishing, and, they released a English version in the UK of my book. And I went over there. I flew to, London, and, I did about 9 days worth of I did book signings in London and Manchester, I think Normandy, and then at the end of that they had a Northern Soul Weekender in Cleethorpes. So I rehearsed with a band from London, and I was the opening act for the Valvolettes in this show that we did, and I appeared my first performance in the UK wearing one of their team's soccer shirts, and it we had a great time, and then the book was number 6 in London, and then when I came back here, Susan Whitehall's a writer for the Detroit News here, and she recommended to the University of Michigan Press that they take a look at this book. And they took a look at it and decided they wanted to publish it here in the U.S. and Canada, but they wanted me to update it from some of my other activities, like the Standing in the Shadows of Motown film and the again, the Rhythm, Love, and Soul piece I did for PBS, so I kind of updated the book, and kind of the English wanted me to give it an English touch, and the folks over here wanted me to make it more current and a little Americanized. So that's how this thing happened.
Well, just the cover alone it shows some roadies putting together the, you know, just, and the title is inspired Guitars, Bars, and Motown Superstars. In one of the descriptions, it mentions that you slipped Gordy's draconian rules. What are you referring to there, if you wouldn't mind telling us that part of it?
Well, a lot of the musicians, most of the Funk Brothers, were signed to exclusive contracts to Berry Gordy. I was not, and the one time I came close to that is I did a master recording of Isley Brothers tune called It's Your Thing, and Mike Theater and I produced it, and he sent a copy of that to Clarence Avant, and I handed a copy of it to Hank Cosby, who was Motown's contractor and Stevie Wonder's producer, and Hank Cosby and Jamerson, the bass player, were the first two people who called me to work at Motown. So anyways, within a couple of months, Clarence Avant, signed me up to a deal. He says, I want to sign you up to an artist deal, and you and Michael produce it, and we're going to do an album. So I did an album, and at the time, Clarence was involved with MGM with a label over there called Maverick at MGM. So I had an album out called Hair and Things. It was kind of a rough-sounding, you know, kind of a progressive R&B type thing. And the one song, It's Your Thing, was a number one hit in Detroit, but they couldn't spread it out. And shortly that label kind of went under, and then Clarence started his own label of Sussex. But to make a long story short, then Hank Cosby approached me later and said, well, Berry Gordy wants to sign you up. He loves this song. And I said, well, I already signed a contract with someone else because I didn't think you guys were interested because of the time lapse, you know. But other than that, I had never been signed to them. I worked for them in the producer's workshop, you know, where, you know, they just hired me to do, you know, four nights a week, you know, just like that. But I was never under any kind of exclusive contract to them. So I pretty much did what I wanted.
Oh, that's an amazing story. Tell us again where the book is available.
The book is available certainly at all Borders bookstores. You can order it on Amazon. .com and probably others. I don't know. I've just seen it at Borders, and I know it's on Amazon.com.
The Four Tops, long about 70, 71, turned out an album called Still Waters Run Deep, and you were very involved in that. The album is on the album, there's a track called Still Water, paren love. Apparently it was co-written by Smokey Robinson. Tell us about your involvement with that track and also with the Four Tops.
Well, you know, again, it was just another session at Motown. The only difference is Frank Wilson, I think, was the producer. And we were recording that song for some reason because of the vision he had of that thing, where the beats went, it sounded like it was backwards. And it was really a little bit different. When I heard it on the radio, it sounded great, but in the studio, it sounded a little strange. But the Four Tops is just, you know, I was part of the studio band, so I was doing two sessions every day there, and that was the outcome of one of them. And then, of course, a couple of years ago, I did Four Tops' 50th anniversary, and they taped it. It showed on PBS and Channel 7, and the highlight of the show is they brought Levi out, and he had been ill. So he came out in the wheelchair, but his voice still sounded strong. So you got Levi singing a duet with Aretha Franklin, doing a couple verses, and you got the Four Tops on one side singing harmony and the Temptations on the other side. I'll tell you, it was great.
Wow, what a moment. And I should tell the listeners, Dennis has been involved in a number of documentaries, Standing in the Shadows of Motown. He was also in the PBS special Rhythm, Love, and Soul. Also, From the Heart, the Four Tops' 50th anniversary TV special. And you're no stranger to the limelight. What is it like, even from work you did so long ago, to be recognized in specials like this? And it must give you a wonderful feeling, even though you're under pressure to put the stuff out more times than not. It has to be a wonderful feeling.
Well, I thought it was the greatest feeling in this huge trophy that they gave us, this award, Pioneer Award, that the R&B Foundation gave us here a few days ago. I mean, as really being pioneers of the music and our historical impact on R&B music. You know, to be recognized by a group of folks that, when you're looking at, I mean, Jerry Butler just brought the house down with the Your Precious Love. I mean, unbelievable. And Dionne Warwick was just great, and Bonnie Raitt was great. I mean, you just had all these superstars. And to be recognized by an organization like that, I mean, just doesn't get any better than that.
Dennis, is this available on DVD? Can we somehow see this?
I didn't see anybody taping it. Usually, when I did the Four Tops thing, you could see it was done in a huge theater that had capabilities for doing this. They had camera booms and all this stuff. And I saw the same thing in Pittsburgh at the Benham Theater when we did the PBS special. I did not see that at this theater, so my assumption is it's probably not.
Wow, what a wonderful loss. Well, we talked about your involvement with the Still Waters track. Many of you may not recognize that, but it was top 30. I think it went to number 11, actually. But in any case, it's a wonderful song. You will remember it. And I wanted to be sure we got this in. Still Water, I guess.
Walk with me. Take my hand.
Amazing, and you are the common thread that has run through so much, in fact, all of this wonderful music. Dennis, what is going on with you and I think your son? Did you just recently put out a new CD? What's that about? I just caught a glimmer of that.
What I did is I recorded a live CD at a place I play at once a month called Baker's Keyboard Lounge in Detroit. And it's a jazz club that's been in existence for 73 years. One of the oldest jazz clubs in the United States, maybe even in the world. And I did a live CD of it, but I haven't really got it released with a label or anything. It's just something that I wanted to capture, you know, at the time. And that was something that that I just put together.
Wonderful. Were you doing a solo guitar on that CD, or are you with a group?
No, that's a live band. Played live. I had Ed Wolfram, which is he's an extraordinary sound engineer from the old days, where he was chief engineer for United Sound. He worked at Terry Shermer. He worked at Motown. He invented this direct box, and he's still a very dear friend. And he went in, recorded this thing so great that one label said it can't possibly be live. It's too clean.
Wow. Wow. Where can one find that CD?
You can't. I'm just waiting for a label maybe to put it out. I'm not selling it online or anything yet, so I'm just looking. I'd like to see a label stand up, independent label perhaps, that may want to take that on.
Interesting. Well, Dennis, if you can think of it, if you have a an individual track you let us have here to run some night as a sneak preview, we'll certainly run it on the show, and we won't distribute it in any way, but that's completely up to you. In other words,
well, what I would do is I've got a version of Scorpio you've probably never heard before on this thing, so we'll talk later.
Wonderful. Listen, about Henry Stone, do you know him? Have you met him? He came up in the chat room. Henry has been a guest on the show. Did you work with Henry Stone? You know, he's been around a long, long time, too.
Yeah, I did a group for TKA Records. I'm trying to think of the name of this girls group that we did for him. But it kind of escapes me right now what the name of that group was. But we did that for TK Records directly. You know, I met him in New York at one of the conventions and said we had a project we'd like to do for him, and we did that record. Again,
very
I've gotten so many things going on here that the name escapes me right now.
He lives in South Florida now, and he has done so much fine music. Let's see, I have an email from him. He's doing a first recorded from the of the Twist by Henry Stone, or rather, would have been what was his name?
Chubby Checker.
The Twist. Thank you, Chubby Checker.
Okay.
And yeah, I'll send you a link to Henry, and I'm sure it will jog your memory what an interesting fellow he was. You know, the show would not be complete unless we mentioned your relationship with the Temptations. Now, this was, I think, back in the, when was it, the early 70s when Just My Imagination, I think it was, came out?
The first record I did for the Temptations was Cloud Nine, and that was the Wawa thing. And then I did all that stuff, you know, Runaway Child, Can't Get Next to You, Psychedelic Shack. I did everything with the Temptations up to Just My Imagination. Except I did not do Papa Was a Rolling Stone because I was on the road promoting Scorpio. So Wawa Reagan did that. But all the rest of them I did from Cloud Nine all the way up to Just My Imagination.
Wow. Well, we have a copy of that. It's, of course, a song that no one who's ever heard it will forget. By the way, Glenn points out in chat that the group that we were trying to think of was the Tempest Trio.
Right.
On Marlin Records.
Well, these people got a better memory than me, but I try.
These guys in the chat room are younger than us both, so they can remember.
It is homework.
Yes. The track, Just My Imagination, tell us how that was written. Was that also one of these you-got-to-do-it-in-hour tracks? It'd be hard to believe if it is.
Sometimes Whitfield Norman, of course, was my kind of patron over there. He just liked what I did, and he'd say, you know, show me some new tricks. What do you got in your bag today? And I'd pull his stuff out and that stuff out. And he said, great, I'd like it. Put it on here. And with Just My Imagination, I created that intro figure. And you can hear guitarist Eddie Willis doing a little answer there. You know, I'm doing that. That's me. And then Eddie answers it with a little figure.
Wow. And you're the common thread. Agnes, if you'd roll that track, please. We have it uploaded. It's Just My Imagination. Dennis, as I wipe a tear from my eye, what a wonderful, wonderful song. Inspired, really, and the lyrics too. Who wrote that song?
I'm sure that was Norman Whitfield, and he wrote with, trying to think of the other guy's name. Strong, Barrett Strong. They wrote a lot of songs together. I don't know if they both wrote that song together or not, but I know they were writing partners for most of the Temptations thing.
Wow. Well, the Temptations, wonderful group.
If the listeners go on YouTube, they can see a live version of me doing an instrumental thing on Just My Imagination.
Really? So yeah. You would go to YouTube and do a search on Dennis Coffey. By the way, folks.
Yeah, go on to YouTube and put my name in, and there's three things of me playing live, and then there's a bunch of other folks that have done different things with my records.
Wow.
But at least three of me playing live.
And to remind the listeners, that's spelled C-O-F-F-E-Y. And, yes, and I'll go ahead and add those links to the YouTubes to the Strictly Confidential site. Earlier, In our conversations this evening, you mentioned Buckwheat Zydeco was at the Ponderosa Stomp. Now, this Ponderosa Stomp, is that a regular event? How did you get involved with this?
Well, you know, again, people, you know, call me up, and this guy, Dr. Reich, who's a physician down there, has a Ponderosa Stomp event every year give recognition to some of the unsung heroes of the music business, and he somehow decided that I fit that bill. And so he set me up. He says, I want you to come down here and be part of this show. And so I agreed, and I was going to go down and do Ponderosa in New Orleans. And then Katrina hit before we could do the show. So then he called me after Katrina hit, and things had settled down, so at least you could, you know, make a few phone calls. And he said, we are going to move the show to Memphis at the Gibson Guitar Factory in their concert hall. And he says, would you mind making it a benefit for us instead of us paying you? And I said, absolutely. So I went down there, and the backing band at the time, again, was Little Buck Cynical, or the guitar player, and his band, and the New Orleans guys. And I had Buckwheat Zydeco on B3 organ, and we just cranked out some serious funk in Memphis. And
wow.
Then the following year, Dr. Ike called me and said, I want you to do South by Southwest in Austin with the guys, and I want you to do the House of Blues with the guys as part of the Ponderosa Stomp. And the South by Southwest was kind of a lead-in to the Ponderosa Stomp. And then while you're here, I want you to play the Circle Bar the next day. There is a video of me playing in the Circle Bar with a couple of musicians, a bass player and a drummer from Memphis, and Uganda, a famous conga player from New Orleans. So somebody took that on a phone or something, but it's on YouTube as well. But that's how that whole thing kind of evolved.
Wow, what a story you have. I'm so grateful to you and Glenn both for that you're sharing it with us. We talked about the list of folks you have worked with, and in that list there was Ringo Starr and Barbra Streisand. Those names certainly stand out. What happened with those two, and what were they like? Do you remember those days?
The segue, I'll lead this up. There's a story that goes with, let's start with Barbra Streisand.
Okay.
You know, Barbra Streisand, sometimes you read about her being kind of hard on folks or what have you. So I got a call to play live with the orchestra with Barbra Streisand, and I was going to play acoustic guitar and, you know, electric and what have you. So we go to a rehearsal studio Columbia Records had, and as we walk in the door, now you're talking about a full, there must have been 60 of us there. I mean, a full orchestra. As far as not symphonically, but certainly a full string section and horns and everything else, there's must have been 62 players there. We walk in the door, and Barbra Streisand has this whole serving table laid out with all these nice foods and hors d'oeuvres and whatever you want, and she's standing at the head of the line introducing herself to every musician and shaking her hand. So that was incredible. And then during the concert that night, I mean, this is one of the, her and Aretha are the two best female singers that I've ever backed up. And she was just mesmerizing. Her performance was just impeccable. And it was interesting because we were doing the way we were, and I was playing acoustic, and one of the strings broke. And, you know, I got six, so I guess five will do. So I played on the end of five. So I usually get by with those kind of things because I just keep on plowing. So I don't think anybody knows it, but she was just mesmerizing. What a great artist. So the end of the story, that's one chunk of the story. So the next week I get a call from Motown, and they say, we want you to play with the Jackson 5, which included Michael at the time, and Janet was about 8. And we want you to play with them at the same kind of concert for the Motown folks. And I says, well, okay. I says, when do I rehearse? And they says, well, funny thing happened at rehearsal. The guitar player is no longer there. So they said, you don't get any rehearsal time, and Motown specifically wants you to come in and cut this show with no rehearsal and you the charge. And I says, is there any way out of this? Now that's pressure. And they said, well, you know, we are paying you scale and a half for every session you do out here for us, and we would be very perturbed if you didn't do it. And this is one time I realized that I had to give in. So I played the whole show. I mean, they did a medley of Benny Goodman, Sing Sing Sing, and they did this and they did that. So I pretty much got through their whole show with no rehearsal, and I don't think I embarrassed myself or them. At least I hope not. But it was interesting.
Wow, fascinating. And Ringo Starr, how did that come about?
I had done a few sessions. The first time I met Richard Perry, we did an album on Martha Reeves for MCA. And then I got a call later on to do this Goodnight Vienna album with Ringo. And so I did a few cuts on that. And then I was up on this expedition up on the High Sierras, and I get a phone call up there to come down and do a couple overdubs. So when I got done with my camping trip up there, I came back down. But only in Hollywood do you get a call in the middle of a High Sierra saying, well, you know, we got a session down here. Can you, you know, so when I got back to the base camp, you know, I got this message that I needed to call them when I got back, you know. And we were on horseback up in the mountains. So, you know, this was before cell phones. So we got the message at the base camp. And so once I got back, I show up at the studio. And the only people there that are on time are me and Ringo. So Ringo gets to hear about my hunting trip and my camping trip and what have you. And so for an hour, I'm entertaining him, and he was very nice about the whole thing. And then Richard Perry pulls up in a Bentley, and he's wearing bib overalls and everything.
Oh, great. My stars.
So
Bentley, yes, go ahead. Are you still together?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay, great. I need to ask you about Ride Sally Ride. Now, everyone remembers, when was that, in the 60s or the 70s? What was the group that did that? Was it the Dave Clark Five? Who was the story that remember the Ride Sally Ride and the Mustang?
I know, that was the title of another song.
Oh, it's a different song. Okay,
yeah.
So that's why I'm confused. Tell us about the song, the Ride Sally Ride, that you have, that we have a copy of, and what's the story on that?
It's just a song I wrote, and just, what I do is when I write my songs, is I just sit there and wait for ideas to come, and then a song develops, and then I call it number whatever, you know. So I got 10 songs, and I just number them 1, 2, 3, just like, you know, through 10. And once I get the songs done, I title them, because I have no idea how they're going to turn out, you know, as I'm going through the creative process. And I have no idea what came through my mind to call that Ride Sally Ride, but that's what it is.
Interesting. I listened to some of that today, and I thought it was really quite good, but I couldn't find the resemblance with the vocal that I knew. So that's I'm glad you shared that with us. Agnes, if you'd roll part of that, please, or we'll may ride it all the way through. That's Ride Sally Ride. Thank you. Dennis, that's very distinctive. That is definitely the Dennis Coffey sound, without question. Then that was during the 70s that was done?
Yes, huh?
I see. Well, you know, Dennis, there's so much material. There's that, you know, we could do a Dennis Coffey Show Part 1 and a Dennis Coffey Show Part 2, Part 3, for in fact, you could be a regular feature because we would never get through all of the music. It's just overwhelming to me. And I certainly appreciate you being here. There's songs that we didn't get to. We're nearing the top of last hour, so I want to ask you if we can run one more. We have Capricorn's Thing and Taurus and Boogie Magic, Wings of Fire, and It's Your Thing. What would you like us to run in a short story about it, please?
You know what? Why don't you try Boogie Magic? That's a little different than... Because that's part of the Westbound collection, and we haven't even addressed the Northern Soul stuff I did with Del Shannon. I did the Handyman and all the volume stuff, and all was a whole, you know, Open the Door to Your Heart by Daryl Banks. There's a whole other side of this stuff yet.
Wow, we really need you back for another couple of hours. So how is Boogie Magic related to the Northern Soul again? It's part of that group?
That's not. That's just that was something mixed by Tom Moulton as part of the when I came back to Detroit from L.A. But it just had a different kind of, you know, sound according from what my earlier funk stuff was.
I see. Okay, let's it's a Moulton mix too. So let's roll the Boogie Magic track, I guess.
Thank you.
now, Dennis, who is doing the sax? Is that faded out?
Oh, that's a trumpet. Trying to think of the name of the trumpet player. I think it was Marcus Belgrave.
Interesting. Well, you know, that mix has the Tom Moulton signature. Has the dance beat. And it's interesting. I always associate Tom's mixes with vocal disco. I'm surprised to hear that he did this instrumental. How did that come about?
Well, we had already probably done Devil's Gun and established a relationship with Tom, and he loved that album. He tells me right now, you know, when I heard from him about a year ago, he loves that album.
Interesting. Well, I can tell you, Dennis, that the chat room is already demanding that you come back again and visit with us another time with a whole new set of music, and maybe we can explore the northern soul side.
Well, yeah, there's a lot of things on that first album, Hair and Things. There's some super funky stuff on that. That was the album before the Scorpio album.
I see. And that was during. You say that that's a whole separate thing. Was it like two paths of music that you were doing simultaneously, but with different labels?
No,
or how'd that
first
work?
That was the first album I did, and it was kind of connected to when I was playing a jazz gig with Lyman Woodard Trio, and I had him and Melvin Davis on it, and Bob Abbott, bass player, on it, and I think Andrew Smith may have played drums on a few things, too, but it was kind of, some of it was stuff we were doing in the club, and some of it were, you know, tunes from Hair and Things. We did some funky stuff, so it's just a point in time. At least myself as an artist, I look at the kind of music I do as a point in time of where I'm at. What I'm playing in the clubs right now is dramatically different than what I used to, you know, do. So it's just, you know, that's the whole thing, I think, with an artist, to at least try and be somewhat relevant. You have to be creative and come up with new things. You can't just lock into a certain style. Some artists can. Me, like I say, I think I got a short attention span. I got to do new stuff all the time to keep myself interested.
Wow. I don't think you've written half the stuff that's in you.
I just completed, I'm doing a traditional jazz project for Assumption Grotto Church here in Detroit, and I've just written 10 songs for them, and I've got 10 other songs in the can, and I'm just now got 5 songs partly written, so I'm going to do another 10 here. Just I'm in this spurt now, so I'm going to do 10 real funky things.
Wow, Assumption Grotto. Yes. Well, you know, one wonders the style of music. Is this a? I take it with the name. It may be a Catholic church. Is it? What is it? Is it a high energy?
No, it's a Catholic church that Father Perone and sound engineer Ed Wolfram resurrected the works of Paul Perret, a classical composer, and they've probably got 12 to 13 CDs out of his symphonies that they recorded in Grotto Church, and they want to start a jazz label traditionally, because Paul Perret also wrote some jazz pieces that they're trying to track down. So to start the jazz label, I wrote 10 original songs to kind of kick this thing off, but they're classical guitar, but they're traditional jazz pieces.
Interesting. Now, one then assumes that the church, you chose it because of the wonderful acoustics?
Well, it's the relationship with the church and Ed Wolfram and Father Perone, because they've used the money from the sale of the CDs to help the church stay open. So it's not really about anything other than working with some good folks. And I think at this stage of my life, it's kind of what I need to do. It's giving something back, you know, and helping people, you know, they're worshiping God in this church. And this is what I'm doing, at least at this first piece. So they've already pretty much approved the 10 songs, so they're just finding the resources now to be able to do that, you know, not for me, but for the other folks, the musicians and so forth.
Okay, wonderful, wonderful story, and we do religion on this show, too, so that's a whole other show. That's like the third or fourth show. I have to run. We've come up right on the top of the hour, so I have to rush off, but Dennis, I love you. They love you. Thank you from the bottom of my heart.
I appreciate it, and I appreciate your interest. I've got the BBC coming over here Monday to do a whole thing from London on me. We're going to tape it in my living room. And I do interviews because I'm appreciative of people having an interest in my music and the listeners and people like yourself putting me on the air and online and so forth. So, yeah, I appreciate you doing it.